Crime, bringing Seattle to the world and the world to Seattle. Follow us on Twitter at iGuestInfo. Send us your questions and we'll try to answer. Now enjoy the show.
Well, welcome back. Today we have another great show for you. In the first half, we're going to be talking with the executive producer, Pat Arribito, of the award-winning film, Hell and Mr. Fudge, and we're going to bring on the star, Mackenzie Astin. We're going to talk to him. This has just a great lineup with a cast for this film. We're going to talk to Pat a lot about that and how she was able to secure all these big names for this fantastic film that is coming your way, so you're going to want to stay tuned for that. And then in the second half of the show, we're going to have Irish singer, songwriter, school teacher Andy McCarroll is going to come on. He has some thoughts that he's been putting to words with what he sees going on in the United States. So that's going to be interesting as well. A couple weeks ago, if you remember, we had the amazing Oscar winner Patty Duke on. And during that conversation, she mentioned that her son, Mackenzie, had just starred in a film called Hell and Mr. Fudge, and we talked a bit about that on the show, and it sparked an interest in me, and it sparked an interest with a lot of you guys, and you wanted me to follow up on that, and personally I wanted to follow up on it as well too. So I tracked everybody down, and the first person we're going to have on is Pat Arribito. She is the executive producer of this film, and it was written by Donald Davenport. And again, we'll go through kind of the setup of this. This film takes place back in the it's set in the 1970s, and Edward Fudge is commissioned, so to speak, to find out if hell really exists. So I'll let Pat kind of take it from there, and we'll bring her in, and we'll get the conversation started. Thanks, Pat, for coming on.
Hi, Lori. I'm really delighted to be here. Do you want me to phrase the story a little bit?
Yes, go ahead.
Sure. Edward Fudge was and is a real person, still alive. And like you said, he was actually hired to search and see what the Bible really teaches about the existence of hell and whether God really burns people forever if they don't get to go to heaven. He himself believed that. He was what they call a traditionalist. That's the traditional view, and he didn't think he'd find anything different than what he had already believed when he took up the research. The whole story was a challenging experience for him. He lost his job. He got booted from preaching. You know, he had all kinds of things happen to him during that time period. So it was sort of a challenging time in his life. But he made it through.
Right, which happens to a lot of people, and it's great that he could kind of document that, you know, along the way. Because I think everybody has those points in their life.
Yep, we sure do, don't we? Mm-hmm. And sometimes those times in our lives end up being a help or a blessing to other people. That's the surprising part of it.
When did he write this story? Was it recently that he wrote it, or...?
It took place in the 70s. He researched for about a year, and, you know, the person who hired him wanted him to do really thorough research, of course, the Old and New Testament, early and late church fathers, Jewish historians, intertestamental writers. He wanted it to be the most thorough research possible. So after he researched is when he wrote the book. That would have been early 80s when it came out. It's on its third edition now, and he's made some changes. In fact, the third edition's kind of fun because he answers the critics of his other two editions. And he told me that there have been no less than 12 books written about his book. So it's made quite an impact.
Mm-hmm. How did you hear about it, Pat?
You know, I had that book in my library from... I don't know when. I had the first edition in my library, so I knew about it. But when we started talking about doing something on the subject, we invited him as well as a number of other scholars to meet with us and kind of brainstorm about it. And Jeff Wood, our producer-director, had interviewed him for another television show some years before that, so he was a little bit acquainted with him. We didn't really know his story at the time. But we met together for an afternoon with these people, and you know, we just kind of followed up with him and began to hear his story and thought it was really fascinating.
And so then you guys kind of, then you bought the script and kind of just ran with it. What's the reception been?
We actually produced the script, too. I mean, we did this from the ground up.
Wow.
Started talking to him, got his story, went back to where he lives in Texas a number of times just to sit down and get his story, you know, hired a writer, all that, and, you know, did it from the ground up. It was, you know, a period of about probably 2-3 years from the time we started talking to him about it. But the reception you asked about,
go ahead.
It's been pretty positive. We're actually very positive. A lot of good response from it so far.
Well, there's kind of been a big shift in fundamentalism. Of course, you probably, you know, there's still the super, super traditionalists, but I think that over time people have kind of loosened their reins on it, hell being black or white, you're going or you're not type of thing. I think there's more of a gray area with most of the mainstream population. My family's from the South, and I grew up with a lot of older fire and brimstone Baptist people in my family, too, and I had to watch them evolve over time, as I think a lot of people have with members of their family.
I think so, too. It's not really, like, politically correct to think of God as being so cruel right now. And even among some of the mainstream religions, like you said, who have preached hellfire and brimstone for years, many of their scholars don't buy it anymore, you know, because it really paints God in a bad light. I think it's really good timing, too, because there's just a lot of talk about it right now. Rob Bell's book came out a year and a half ago, whenever it was, and there's another documentary that's come out on the subject, and I think people are really talking about it right now, so it's a good time to find out what the Bible really teaches.
Well, exactly. And, you know, I think for a long time people were afraid to kind of speak out, as Mr. Fudge found out when he started researching himself. He wasn't received with open arms either.
A lot
of people went after him.
Yeah, basically shunned in his own church, you know, for 30 years. It was not considered a very popular view. And, you know, there are people who feel that if you don't have something, you know, to terrify people, you don't have a tool for evangelism. So I think it's been the doctrine of eternal torment has been used to control people or to scare people into the church, which I don't really see God being that kind of God.
Right, right. Well, you know, discipline, corporal punishment has kind of been a way of thinking for parents with children a lot of times, and then you can, and the church kind of can regulate that way too when they don't know how to kind of keep people in control. They kind of scare them with the totalitarian way of keeping things. But now we're evolving as a species, and we're thinking a little more outside the box. And like you said, you know, more of a loving God, and how would God? I mean, if you go right back to the Bible, and you go into the New Testament with Jesus, I mean, Jesus says, you know, the greatest of all of these things, if you walk away with nothing else, just remember that the greatest of all these things is love, and that's the foundation to start with.
The Bible talks about God's justice and his mercy. And if you look at it in that light, you know, if God truly is just and truly is merciful, how could it possibly be justice to torment someone, to keep them alive in fire for eternity for 70 years of sin? You know, it doesn't make any sense. It's
right.
That obviously couldn't be just,
exactly.
Much less merciful.
Exactly. I never even thought of it about that way, but yes, you're right. You know, it's been eternity for just a blink of an eye. for here on Earth.
Yeah. But, you know, as a parent, I've got children.
Right.
I could never, you know, I had to punish my children at times, but, you know, you could never, ever perpetrate that kind of pain on another human being. How could God, who's much more loving than us, do that?
Exactly. Exactly. Where was this film? Because on the trailer, it's very green.
Very green. We filmed it in Athens, Alabama, where the story actually took place. We went back there to do a little scouting, you know, to see if it was a good idea. And, you know, it is beautiful. It's gorgeous there. And the town just opened their arms and welcomed us. Some of Edward's close friends still live there. And there were people who remembered parts of the story that Edward had forgotten that we were able to meet with. So we decided to film it right there, and it was just great. The town supported us. Extras came out. The mayor's office helped us out. Local people, you know, it was just the perfect place to do it. We ended up taking it back there when it was finished and showing it for free to the town as a gift of thanks to them. And we ended up having to show it 3 times to accommodate all the people who wanted to see it.
That's great. Well, you had an amazing cast. I wanted to talk about that a little bit. You had so many great people sign on to this film, starting with, of course, Mackenzie Aston, who's going to join us a little bit later, Carrie Lynn Pratt, Wes Robertson, John Wesley Shipp. I mean, it just goes on and on and on. And I wanted to say, people can go to helenmrfudge.org and find out more information and look at the trailer themselves and be able to see it. Where are we at with the distribution of this film, and how can people see it, or how can they get a hold of it?
Yeah, we haven't officially released it yet, but we are doing pre-release screenings across the country, kind of testing the waters and seeing what kind of response we get. And we actually don't have a specific release date yet. It will most likely be next month, and we'll let everyone know that. As it is now, you just have to go to the website and look at our schedule to see where it's showing.
And you're actually showing it in a lot of churches itself.
We're showing it in a few churches. We're showing it in theaters. We're even showing it in some little towns where there is no theater and the local people want it, and we work with them to bring it to another kind of public venue. Some little towns are bringing it to their school gym or places like that. So, yeah, we work with local people to bring it, and we've had a really good success with that because there's a lot of support, you know, for a screening when we do it that way. In fact, if anyone's interested, they can contact us through our website, and we'd let them know how it works and what needs to be done.
And then the cast, so let's talk about the cast a little bit, because you just, like I said, you just had an amazing cast that showed up for this film, directed by Jeff Wood. But then, again, Donald Davenport wrote it, and then Mackenzie Aston signed on, Gary Grubbs, Victor McKay, Sean McGowan. You know, the list just goes on and on. Tell us about your experience working with this great lineup of actors.
Well, of course, first is casting. We cast through Craig Capobasso there in L.A. for our leads. And Mac and Carrie Lynn actually auditioned together, and they were just great. You know, they were first choice right off the bat. Did so well together. We cast back in Huntsville for our local cast, and Gary Grubbs came in there, and John Wesley Shipp. Sean McGowan and Wes Robertson came from out in California. And, you know, there was such a sense of teamwork. Part of what I love about production is the kind of teamwork that develops between cast and crew and everyone working together just to make it the very best. And we had that, you know, that synergy of people just working hard, loving what they were doing, doing a fantastic job. You come to love these people that you work with. You know, we filmed for 15 days, long days, so we were together a lot and got to know each other. Just had such a, you know, such a really tremendous experience together.
Well, it seemed like that everybody just really gelled, and it was a kind of a natural fit. It really did seem like all those people knew each other, and you know there was a real relationship there.
Mhm, mhm. You know, they the cast would work together early morning and late at night on their parts before they had to do it the next day. So they, you know, they gelled that way. You know, then they'd hang out together. Yeah, there was just really. Of course, we were all away from home, so you're doing everything together. And then the community members who pitched in and helped us became part of that team too.
Well, yeah, because since you were filming right where it took place, it's that had to kind of rub off maybe just a little bit, that you were able to pick up some of that local flair and the vibe of what was going on there.
I think so. You know, and the controversy that had existed there in the 80s, amazingly, still exists to some extent. We ran into, both sides from back
mm-hmm.
then. One of our cast even was a little nervous about having her picture put up on our website too soon because she was afraid of her family's reaction when they found out she was in the film. There was a local preacher who was really worried about what we were going to say. I think he was afraid we were going to make his church look bad, or he felt like we were maybe going to be dishonest with the story or something, and you know, he published a big letter in the newspaper and sent emails to us about it. So it was really interesting to actually pick up the flavor of the conflict 30 years later.
Well, yeah, I think that there is, you know, maybe a little bit of distrust about what Hollywood, when Hollywood comes to town.
I'm sure.
What's going to happen?
I don't think
but, yeah,
we really see ourselves as Hollywood, you know. We don't see ourselves in that light.
Well, I remember years ago I was working in Paris, California. Perris, California. And they came in and they filmed. You know where it is? It has its own flavor, too. But they filmed Calendar Girl there, and it was a really big deal. Jason Priestley was in that movie at that time. And they came, and Paris at that time was really small. It's outside of Temecula and Lake Elsinore's Paris near Riverside. But it was a big deal for Paris when they came and shot that movie, and I was working there, and I mean, everybody was talking about it, and even though it wasn't a huge blockbuster film, for Paris and for all of us there, it was a huge deal. So I can kind of wrap my brain around what they must have been thinking in Athens at that when you guys came in.
Sure, it was a big deal. And it was really fun
mm-hmm.
because we needed extras for our crowd scenes and our church scenes. And it was great for the community to get to come and be in the film and then see themselves in the finished product. They loved it. We also needed period cars. And, you know, those people in town that were or in the area that were part of the car clubs loved bringing their cars from the 60s and 70s to be in the film. So we have some beautiful cars in there.
It's amazing what local people have hidden away, and if they just produce it when you ask, all of a sudden they just start bringing treasures out of the house, like you wouldn't believe.
It was so true.
What do you want people to walk away from, Pat, after they see this film?
I want people to walk away knowing that God truly is a God of love and compassion, that He's not cruel and vindictive, and that He's not a tyrant. That's the bottom line. In the film, we really have two themes in the film. We have the theme of what happens to the lost, and we have the theme of grace, that God's grace is big enough for everyone, that it's meant for everyone, that God is a God of compassion.
Well, that's the way I perceive God, being merciful and graceful, and that's a great way for us to pattern our life and try to remember that and keep that as a focal point in our life when we're going through the human experience day after day after day. It's very easy for us to fall into, I would do this better or worse, or to judge other people. And I think it's a conscious effort to try to stay focused on what the true message is about God, and that's love.
I totally agree. And part of the strength of our film, I think, is that Edward himself lived with that kind of grace and exhibited that kind of grace. You know, when he went through the challenges of losing his job, you know, he responded with grace. And he even says in the film, you know, I can't be mad at those people. They've been so good to me. And I think his life exhibited that grace that's so part of the character of God. I had a man
and
at the end of a screening came up to me and he says, you know what I got out of this film? He says, what I got out of this film was that God is really good and I want to be like that. And I thought, yes, that's our goal, and he got it.
Mhm. Well, that's you know what we all say we strive for, but then putting it into practice is a totally different thing. And so it's good to be reminded, you know,
and inspired by people who who live that.
Yes, yes, definitely. And those people, it's great when they speak out and they write and then they make movies, just like you're doing, because it just gives us reminders on the path. It's like little breadcrumbs, you know. You just you keep following, you know, and you have these little reminders along the way that kind of keep you, you know, going towards the goal of love and grace and, you know, trying to make.
It's so true. We don't realize either how much impact the little grace that we have has on people around us. You don't know you're being watched. You know, at the time, I'm sure it never entered Edward's mind that the way he was responding to the things that were happening in his life would bless other people someday or would reflect what God is really like to people. You never know.
Well, especially when he was going through it and he was under the fire at that time. I mean, it took a long time for him to see the benefit, 30 years, for him to kind of see this whole thing play out. It probably didn't feel so good at the time.
Absolutely not. It was a very rough experience for him and his family. You know, they all suffered. His friends said the best thing they ever did was move out of town.
That's harsh.
Yeah. But
when you have to move.
A new life.
When you have to move, things are not well, you know, when it comes to that point. And back then it was harder to move than it is today.
Yeah.
Well, what's been Mr. Fudge's reaction to the film?
You know, when we first showed it to him, before it was finished, we were still in post, we brought him in and showed it, and he cried. He's a real tender, emotional man anyway, and he just cried. You know, the thought that his story would have meaning later and could be something really meant a lot to him. And he's just, you know, totally on board. He loves it. He, you know, we became so close to him through all of this. We love him. He's dear to our hearts. He loves us. We're kind of like family. And he's really thrilled that the film and that the story of his life can have meaning and can do something good.
Well, it's probably a full circle moment for him.
I think so. Yeah, I think so.
That's amazing. Amazing.
We showed it, we screened it in his hometown. He lives near Houston. In fact, it's been shown there a couple of different times. And for him to see it in his hometown with the people that are part of his circle now, you know, was really tremendous.
Well, good for him because, you know, he gets redeemed publicly.
Mm-hmm. Yep. It's true. His book also is considered one of the most authoritative books on the subject now. It's very highly respected in scholarly circles. You know, it's a very in-depth research on the subject. And his book has been very redeeming, too. He's highly respected.
Did you get him to sign your first edition book?
You know, I don't think I did, but I do have a third edition book signed by him. He also wrote another book that goes along with the film. It's a much smaller book, and it tells more of his own personal journey. And that book's titled Hell, A Final Word. Much easier for the average person to read than the research book.
Yeah.
But, you know, if anyone really wants to know specifically and exactly what the Bible teaches about the fate of the lost, The Fire That Consumes, which is the book that came out of his research, is the book to read. You can have no question about it after you read that book.
The Fire That Consumes?
The Fire That Consumes.
That's one of his books, and he also has Hell, The Final Word, so people can find that. And does he write under the last name of Fudge?
Mm-hmm, Edward Fudge.
See, so that's easy to remember. How can we forget that? That's a name you don't forget.
As he says in the film, as good as it tastes.
Well, I am looking forward to this coming out and being able to see the whole thing. I've seen the trailer online. I'm just a fan of the film. I can't wait to see it. This whole genre of Christian films is new and growing, I think.
Yeah, I think so too. And, you know, it's a Christian film. It's also just a wonderful human interest story. Here's something else that's interesting to me. I read a Pew Forum survey that was done in 2008 and said that in the United States, over 60% of the people believe that God tortures sinners in hell for eternity. And I think that is really a huge percentage of people that believe that. You know, we need to speak to that. We need to, for one thing, relieve those fears. You know, Mac talked about his mom, Patty Duke, and how, you know, she grew up with a fear of eternal torment. And I think many, many people have that fear. And I know people personally who have just thrown God out completely because of being taught that. And they really can't put that idea together with the idea of God being a God of love. You know, they don't fit. So what's the real truth there? What does the Bible really teach?
Right. Right. Well, and people have to be afraid not to go out and look for the answer. That's not a sin to go looking for the answer.
No, absolutely not. It's better to go looking than to just toss God out completely.
Exactly.
Me.
Well, I really like the God of love figure a lot better than living the God of living in torture and condemnation and hell and hell and fire for all eternity. That doesn't make passing to the other side look very well, because who's going to pass that bar anyway?
Well, no one, you know. I mean, we can all look at ourselves and realize if it was a matter of me being good enough, forget it.
Exactly. Well, I've always had to say that I always thought my grandparents were super loving and as close to I saw as being perfect. And I always had joked around that they would dig a hole in the back of heaven when no one was looking and pull me through. That was how I was going to get there.
That's a beautiful picture, isn't it?
But they loved me so much that they would go to the back and let me in the back door when no one was looking. But it's not really like that. I think that God loves us all infinitely, just like you were saying. Even more as parents, we can relate to how much we love our children, and God loves us more than that. And, you know, He's going to be just.
He made Jesus the door, you know, that we could all come in.
Exactly.
So much.
Exactly. Well, thank you, Pat, for coming on. I really appreciate you taking the time today. You have a busy schedule. I was gone last week, and so I'm so grateful that we were able to get together and at least get the word out and have people looking for it. They can go to hellandmrfudge.org to find out more information and stay up to date.
I'm so delighted to be here, Lori. Thank you very much. And also helenmrfudge.com There's also a Facebook page, Hell and Mr. Fudge Movie on Facebook. And
oh, great.
Hell and some of your listeners there.
Yes, on the Facebook page, and that was a movie. Got it. Okay, I want to get that out too. And we have a .com, we have a .org, and then we have the Facebook page. Great. Well, we definitely want to support the movie, and we'll be in touch, and I just wish you all the best.
Thank you so much, Lori, and all the best to you too.
All right. Thanks, Pat. Have a great day.
You too. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye. All right, that was the executive producer of the movie Hell and Mr. Fudge. We're going to be back in just a moment with the star of Hell and Mr. Fudge, Mackenzie Astin. And you all know Mackenzie is the son of John Astin and Patty Duke, Hollywood legends. That gene pool just pushed out some really great children actors coming right from the parents, so the apple doesn't fall far from the tree. And we will be right back. I'm going to play Ray Bolts' I Will Choose to Love. You know I'm a big fan of Ray's. We're going to listen to Ray, and I'll be right back with Mackenzie Astin.
Their fists at me, and I will be myself and live in authenticity. And though they wrap their hatred in a message from above, I will choose to love. I will choose to care when I see a soul in need. I will treat each life with respect and dignity. I will not be selfish when it's time to share.
was Ray Bolt and his I Will Choose to Love You. Now, I'm a big fan of Ray Bolt. I support Ray Bolt, so I Will Choose to Love. You can find that, of course, on iTunes. You can follow and you can get Ray's music. Anyway, we are back with the star of the film of Hell and Mr. Fudge, Mackenzie Astin, and I am just thrilled to have him on. We just got off the phone with Pat, the producer, and she kind of gave us a background on the film, and Mackenzie's going to kind of give us his take on it from the guy who was actually portraying Mr. Fudge in the film. Thanks, okay. Mackenzie, for coming on.
Oh, thanks so much for having me. It's a pleasure to be here. From the guy who was lucky enough to play the part of Edward Fudge, because as an actor, having a part to play where the character is a real hero and a real decent fellow is a very fortunate experience for me.
Well, I wanted to ask you about that because Mr. Fudge is a real life person, and so you had to have that in the back of your mind. He's alive today. He's
yes.
alive and kicking, and so he's going to be watching what's going on.
Yeah, it can be a little daunting. That's the second time I've played someone in a film who is actually a real person who's still around, it can be a little daunting because you want to make sure you dot all the I's and cross all the T's. And I had the good fortune to find a couple of his sermons online that were recorded, and so I was able to listen to a couple of sermons of his and get an idea of what he sounded like for starters, but also get an idea of the kind of guy he was. Now, you can tell on a couple of the recordings I heard, you could tell that he's a guy who really relates well to the audience to whom he's speaking, and that he's a genuinely decent fellow. And again, that is such a treat for an actor to portray somebody who's a good guy.
Definitely, definitely. Well, what was it about this script that really got your attention and made you want to, be a part of this film?
Well, there are a couple of things. I've been working as an actor. I've been an actor for quite a while now, about 30 years, and I've had the opportunity to play a number of different parts. And I've been fortunate in some ways in that the majority, I think, of parts that I've been able to play have been, good guys. I noticed a few years back that a lot of the heroes you see in the motion pictures that are made in this day and age are heroes because they beat the bad guy up, or are heroes because they're quicker on the trigger than the bad guy. And an opportunity to play somebody who is a hero because of his faith, who is a hero because of the way he includes people, who's a hero because of his lack of judgment of other people, was a real blessing, is one way to put it. And so what stuck out to me when I first read the script is that this is precisely the kind of character, of hero, really, that I feel like we should be promoting in the entertainment industry. I know the shoot 'em ups make a whole bunch of money and people get excited to go see them, but there's part of me, I think, that is my conscience, that worries about the kind of example that we're setting for our younger folks. And so for me, I was a 38-year-old fella, to be able to go work on a part where the hero was such because of his strength of character was an incredible experience. So that's really what stuck out to me. Also, the fellow's struggle. There are a number of pictures that I've seen throughout my life where the main character is someone who was up against all odds, and this seemed to be the case with Edward Fudge, where the study that he undertook surprised him so much that it really, and I'm paraphrasing from the film, it shook him to his foundation. And what stuck out to me about the character in the script and the guy in real life is that his love for his father and his father's teaching were paramount. And so he was able to accept what he learned and still have respect for what his father taught him. And so that's something that I was able to draw upon from my own life, and I feel fortunate to have connected to the character in that way. I think I got lucky, really.
Mm-hmm. Well, as a public, we say that we want these kind of movies, So it's really up to us to go out and support them when they are made, because we say that this is what we want, and our actions need to line up with our words.
Indeed, indeed. You know, but truly, I feel like we need a little help from the higher ups as well. You know, it's a dangerous thing to say as an actor, and kind of a risky position to take. You know, to sort of hold oneself to a bit of a higher standard. And I'm saying this knowing full well that there is some hypocrisy involved, because I have to pay the rent. And so,
right.
You know, even though I had the opportunity to play this wonderful part last year or a couple years ago when we shot it, I've also, in the past few months on television, done some things that are reprehensible. What I think needs to take place, and I think we're getting there as a people, I think what needs to take place is a little bit of maturity in terms of the kinds of stories we're willing to tell. You know, I liken it in some ways to the diet in this country. For a long time, we were happy to stuff our faces with whatever tasted good, and it has become evident to us that the general health of the populace is perhaps not as good as it should be. And so in the past 10 or 15 years, we've seen sort of a shift in the food paradigm, and people are now putting better stuff into their bodies and reaping the benefit for that. And I feel like we're heading towards the same sort of shift as far as our minds go. And, you know, I hope that there are others out there who feel the same, and that we'll see more films that really set a good example, you know, in terms of how to carry oneself through one's life. Now, granted, when I was growing up, I loved to shoot 'em ups just like the next guy. But it wasn't until I began to recognize that perhaps the shoot 'em ups are not so good for everybody that my taste changed. And I feel like, you know, with the national diet, how people are becoming, you know, more amenable to the idea of, say, kale or whole grains or not so much processed food. Hopefully, we're getting ourselves into the position where we're willing to seek out the kinds of projects that will feed our minds as well as we're starting to feed our bodies.
Well, exactly. I think it takes a balance, and I think we got out of balance. And in the film industry, the TV industry, it's a big industry. There's room for everybody, so it would be nice to have some balance in there.
Absolutely, like at a buffet line, you know, to make sure that there's a tray of good food as well as the stuff that tastes good that maybe isn't the best for you.
Exactly, and I'm really thrilled to see higher end actors like yourself signing on to projects like this. Mark Burnett has been really active in bringing a different vision into, you know, television. You know, he does Survivor and those types of reality shows, but then on the other hand, he does the Bible. And I really like to see that balance. I think everybody understands that people have to work and earn a living. When you're an actor, you're playing a part, but it doesn't always have to be like you were saying, that, you know, you pigeonholed into that one shoot 'em up type of thing something that doesn't make you think, that you can go across the board and have different parts, and there's something for everybody, and you can play somebody like Mr. Fudge and then turn around and play someone else. But at least we have Mr. Fudge on the table to talk about.
I think you put it perfectly, Lori, that there's got to be a certain amount of balance out there, and it's totally encouraging to know that there's something like this that's available for people to see. Now, getting it into wider release is where I think we need some help from the higher ups, from the money folk, who may not look at this kind of film as a real moneymaker. You know, it won't be a blockbuster for sure, but. But if they're willing to take the risk to put it out there for people to see, I think you'll find the benefits down the road will be pretty good for, you know, for everybody.
Well, you know, I still kind of am not understanding the resistance in Hollywood, so to speak, with the money people towards kind of this genre, because it has proven. I mean, look at what Mel Gibson did with Passion of the Christ. Nobody would finance that but himself, and it made a huge ton of money. Same with the Bible. Huge, huge audience participation for Mark Burnett in that right now. So there is an audience out there, and I'm not completely wrapping my mind why they're not really going for it at that executive level when there's proven that there's proven to be a track. If somebody like Mel Gibson can come up with Passion of the Christ and it make almost $1 billion, I mean, people have got to take notice with that.
Yeah, I mean that's certainly an example of a certain kind of filmmaking that will have a wide appeal. Who knows? Maybe we're getting closer to that being more of a regular reality. I think it's important. It's important to have hope in that direction. Mm-hmm. And Hell and Mr. Fudge is a perfect example of something that probably wouldn't have been made so easily, so readily, 20, 30 years ago. Thankfully, with the advancements we've made in technology, there was something about this film that just sort of it was destined to be made. Things fell into place in a wonderful manner out there in Athens, Alabama, and Jeff Wood and Pat Arrobito, they really put together a terrific project for not a lot of money. I don't think I'm speaking out of school when I say that. But we were fortunate to have a really good script and to have a terrific cast. We put together a really good bunch of folks who found the material something. I feel like people are thirsty for this sort of thing, and I know to a man or woman, all the actors involved with the project were really, really glad to have something like this to sink their teeth into, which is maybe not the best allegory to use along with thirst, but forgive me.
No, that's I think you're right. I think the timing really is perfect for this right now. I don't think it could come out at a better time. People are ready for this kind of thing. There's an audience for this genre across the board in the mainstream, not just right wing or fundamentalist or anything like that. I mean, I think the mainstream is ready for this.
Yes,
and
yes,
I think the timing could not be better.
From your lips to the distributor's ears.
Well, let's talk about a couple of your castmates, because I watched the trailer and there was a really great chemistry between you and Carrie Lynn.
Well, that was incredible fortune. Carrie Lynn is a very, very talented actress, and she, like I, recognized that this was a terrific part for an actor to play, and we just hit it off. We come from completely different places, but I think we both found an appreciation for the types of people that Edward and Sarah Fay are. Thankfully, what was on the page was easy to play, I feel, between two people who were fond of each other. We got along pretty well. She's a lot of fun. She's a firecracker. I think that was part of the chemistry that the two of us had. But she's also a professional, and that was really terrific. We did a fair bit of rehearsing in our off time, which I think was really helpful when it came time to shoot. It's just one of those things where the two people who had, sometimes you get lucky. Sometimes people work well together, and Carrie Lynn and I were an example of that. And also, she makes whomever she's in the scene with better. And that was fortunate as well. We had a good time.
Well, it just seemed like that everybody just it just gelled. When I was watching the trailer and the clips that I'd been sent, it just felt natural. You were there in the period. You were there at the place it was all happening. It just felt like we were really right there watching it take place, and you just did an amazing job.
Oh, cheers. Thank you. Well, I had a lot of help. I mean, it's a testament to the quality of the script and to the enthusiasm of all the people that were working on it. Everybody sort of had a feeling when we showed up for work that this was an opportunity to do something really good, and even though we you know, we had a relatively limited schedule, and we had to hurry. Things worked out pretty well. We had a crew that that was sort of split between people who had worked on a bunch of stuff before and were, you know, seasoned professionals, and folks who hadn't worked on much but were incredibly enthusiastic. And that combination worked out rather well. I think the enthusiasm that the folks who were relatively new to the movie industry translated to the cast in a lot of ways, and it sort of gave us, you know, you can get jaded. It's possible to get jaded in this business. And the enthusiasm we felt from the folks that were locals from Athens or the you know, the area really translated well to us from out of town. And, of course, you know, Jeff Wood is a professional who did a fantastic
mm-hmm.
job of having a vision all the way through. You know, there were a couple of days where I thought, gosh, did we get enough for that scene? Did we get all the coverage we needed for that scene? And, you know, I shouldn't have second-guessed the man, because he knew exactly which shots he needed for every sequence. And it's, you know, really well put together.
I was just amazed when I saw who all had signed on for this movie. Not only yourself, but Jeff Wood, who's, you know, everybody knows Jeff Wood's name. And there was just one actor after another that was just very familiar. And I was really, again, just thrilled to see the quality of actors and people in the industry that rallied around this project. It was just thrilling to see that kind of talent.
Craig Campobasso, the casting director, deserves a real nod because to a man and woman, every single part in the picture was cast wonderfully. It was just the right person for each part, and all very talented actors, and that makes a big difference in the long run. And I think we were pretty lucky in that respect. So hats off to Craig.
Mm-hmm, definitely. Well. I wanted just to remind people there's a Facebook page, Helen Mr. Fudge Movie. They can go to helenmrfudge.com or helenmrfudge.org and find out more information and kind of stay in step with the distribution of this film. We really want it to get out there to the masses, because it's a quality film. It has a great message, and we have a variety of junk that we can put into our system on a daily basis, and I do. I am a reality TV nut. Let me tell you, I am as bad as they come when it comes to TV, but I do really, really like good stuff, too, so I do like to feed my soul every now and then and have something different to watch. But I watch it all. You know, I'm no snob when it comes to TV. I'll watch about anything, so... But it's nice to have a variety of things to watch.
Indeed. And this film, you know, if people have the opportunity to see it, you'll find that, you know, not only is there a great deal of information about you know, what the Bible actually says about the nature of hell, which, you know, I think for some people, you know, may be sort of surprising, the stuff that Edward Fudge uncovered and studied out, you know, really investigated thoroughly. And not only that, it's a terrific story about the love that exists within the family, the Fudge family, you know, looking after one another and having faith in one another and faith in oneself. And so I think it's inspirational in a lot of different ways. And, you know, you're probably going to learn something, because I sure did.
Well, you know, life is just... I just try to refer to it as just this human experience. You know, we're all just kind of on this short little journey having these different human experiences. And it is great to learn things along the way. And sometimes they're good things and sometimes they're bad things. But it's certainly a lot easier for us when they're good things. And that's
indeed.
What I liked about Edward Fudge. He was able... His experience was good and bad, but he was able to live it and then share it with us, so we didn't really have to experience the negativity that he was going through at that time. We're reliving it through him, but it's really a full circle moment for him, because it came around, and he's kind of, and Pat and I talked about this in the first half hour, about him kind of being redeemed, because it wasn't an easy experience for him at that time. Just like a lot of us, we don't have easy experiences, so they're painful to go through. But now it's coming full circle for him.
Yeah, there are people throughout history that carry a load for a great deal of other people. And I think Edward Fudge is one of those folks. And it's just, fate or destiny or call it what you like, but he's just one of those people in life that carries a load for a great number of other folks and does the work that's necessary in order to come to a conclusion that not just he, but a great deal of other people can benefit from. And mm-hmm. we're fortunate to have those folks in our lives. As an experience for an actor, it was quite lucky for me. But not only that, just as a human being on this planet, to be exposed to Mr. Fudge's teachings is something that, I will carry with me the rest of my life. And I think there's an opportunity for a lot of people to take a great deal from this film. We certainly put
Absolutely.
A great deal into it, and the amount that we put into the film is minuscule compared to the amount that Edward put in to the studies, and to living the life that he's lived. And it's really we're the beneficiaries of it, and there's a debt of gratitude I think that I know I sort of feel towards Edward, and I'm grateful for having him in my life.
Well, absolutely, and I am just thrilled that this story is able to get out because there are a lot of heroes, like you were saying earlier, out there, and their stories never get told. But this is an opportunity for this story to get to be told, and then the rest of us benefit from that. I wanted to tell you one thing before I let you go, McKinney. I want to talk about your mom for just a minute. Your mom on the show a couple weeks ago. What a wonderful, wonderful lady. I mean, one of the kindest, funniest women I've ever had the pleasure of speaking with. Just a kind soul.
Yeah, she's a delight. I got I've said for many years that I hit the jackpot with parents, and she's another one who has lived, has carried a heavy load for a number of people, and the experiences that she's that she went through in her life that she was willing to share with other people have been very beneficial to a great number. And so I really did hit the jackpot. She's a lot of fun, and I'll add this: she's a fantastic cook.
Oh, really?
Yes, she is. She is.
Well, I want to tell you this about. I guess I'll say it on the air. Her fans. Okay, I've interviewed so many people, everybody all over the spectrum. Justin
mm-hmm.
Bieber fans have a reputation of being like the best, craziest fans on the planet, okay?
Right.
I will go on record right now of saying that the Patty Duke fans, give the Justin Bieber fans a run for their money. And if there was a celebrity death match of fans between the Bieber fans and the Patty Duke fans, it'd be very close. Because go ahead.
No, I was going to say, I could think of the perfect guy to produce that show. That'd be Mark Burnett.
It would be Mark Burnett. And I will say, never, never have I had the response from fans like I did when I interviewed your mom. It is just was just off the chart.
Yeah, that's the thing. I mean, she lived her life as an open book for a long, long time, and then she wrote a book wherein she was incredibly candid about some of the tougher experiences that she had. And I think that sort of honesty and openness with folks is incredibly endearing. And I think that a lot of people found it very easy to identify with a great number of her life experiences, and that sort of connection is incredibly, incredibly valuable. And it doesn't surprise me to hear you say that in a lot of ways. although I don't know, man, the Bieber fans they might have the age advantage.
That is true. But I will tell you, they're very, very loyal and rightfully so, because I found her Anna to be just a very beautiful, beautiful spirit, having this human experience, and I was just thrilled to have her on, and she was the one who introduced us to this to this film and made us aware of it, and I'm just really happy to be able to bring that to other people. So thank you, Mackenzie, for coming on. I really appreciate it.
Hey, the pleasure was mine. I enjoyed it, and you know, like you said, I'm glad that we're, you know, exposing this film to as many people as possible. And I also should say thanks to my mom for giving me this opportunity.
Well, she's just a great person. I really enjoyed my time with you. I knew I would, just from our, we had a little bit of interaction before you actually coming on, and I just found you to be very approachable and down to earth, and I just appreciate that, and I just wish you the best of luck with this film. I'm just going to keep encouraging people to get out and see it.
Well, thanks, Lori. It takes one to know one. It really does. So I feel the same way about you.
Well, the next time you're in Seattle, you'll have to give me a call, and I don't know what we'll do, but we'd do something fun.
We'll figure something out. Maybe we'll go see a movie.
There you go. Exactly. All right. Sounds good.
All right.
Thanks, Mackenzie. Have a great day, and thanks for coming on.
I will indeed. Thank you, Lori. Take care.
All right. Bye-bye.
Bye.
All right, that was Mackenzie Astin. You all know him, the son of legendary film actress Patty Duke and film actor John Astin, just a very, very nice guy. I encourage everybody to get out to the movie, Hell and Mr. Fudge. You can go to hellandmrfudge.com or .org. They also have a Facebook page. We're going to shift gears now, and we're going to move over to Ireland. And I have a friend that I have I met him on Twitter, and we've become friends after that. He is a singer-songwriter. He's a school teacher, and he has some really great views on the perspective of life here in the United States. And his name is Andy McCarroll. And I'm going to let you listen to one of his songs called It's Not Easy, and I'm going to get Andy on the line, and we will be right back with Andy McCarroll.
They move me so deeply, I feel I'm in there as well. So you painters and writers, with your brushes and pens, come paint me a picture, fairy tale with a happy end. It's not easy, darling, I'm not sure.
It's not
singer-songwriter Andy McCarroll, and Andy's calling in from Ireland. And we just had a tremendous success with finding talent in Ireland. Not only is the United States here just flooded with talented musicians and singer-songwriters and actors and poets and artists of every genre in between, there's just so much talent in the world, and a lot of that talent is in Ireland. So you just heard Andy's song, It's Not Easy, and you can find more at Andy as we go along at andymccarroll.com. And thank you, Andy, for coming on.
Oh, hi, Laurie. Thank you for inviting me on. Thank you.
No, it's a thrill. I've known Andy almost probably a year because, as everybody knows, I'm a huge Twitter fanatic. I talk to Andy all the time on Twitter, and we email back and forth, and I've played his music on the show before. So this is the Andy McCarroll. When we're talking about the Andy McCarroll, and we're running Andy McCarroll's music on the show, here he is, right here. So by day, Andy, you are a school teacher.
Yes, I am, yeah.
Then at night, you don your cape and become a singer-songwriter.
Yes, I teach 11-year-olds, and I love my job. And it's an integrated school, which is a mixture of both Protestant, Catholic, and other religions and non-religious people in Northern Ireland. So that's my day job. And in the when I get some time outside of family time, I like to write music. I like to write songs.
Well, right now in Northern Ireland especially, kind of has a history of violence and turmoil going on. What's the climate like right now?
Well, things have changed a lot. I mean, since the 60s, 70s and so on, things have changed incredibly. So, I mean, it's very much normal life here. Back then, when you went into shops, you had to be searched every time you went into a shop. Every time you went anywhere, you were stopped by the police or stopped by the army. Your car was searched. But that is all gone. And it's very much normal life now, which is great. It's a lovely place to be. I love Ireland. I've just been up at the north coast at a place called the Giant's Causeway. I don't know if you've heard of it or not, but it was absolutely gorgeous weather, and it's a lovely place to be, lovely place to be. Recommend anybody coming to Ireland.
I would like to go to Ireland. I need to get a passport. One day, maybe this week, I'm going to go down and just apply for a passport, because that's half the battle. Once I get a passport, then maybe actually I will go somewhere. But I've never been anywhere other than Mexico and Hawaii and Canada. Other than that, I haven't been anywhere. I'd love to go to Ireland, though. There's so much talent in Ireland. It's not even that big of a place, but it's flooded with talent. There's a lot of music that affects the world that comes out of Ireland.
Yeah. Oh, it's a good place to be. A lot of talent. A lot of it's just a beautiful place. The people are very, very kind, very nice, very friendly. If you want to have a good chat, a good laugh, Ireland's the place to come to. So recommend that you come anytime. And besides, now that you know so many people, you'd have lots of places to stay.
That is true. I could just, what do they call it when you just sleep on people's couches and, you know, kind of go through.
We have beds here. We have beds here.
Oh, you do have beds. Well, what's it like in Ireland as far as you and I have talked before? The world kind of sees the United States as kind of more of a violent society. Now, in Ireland, what's your crime rate like?
In comparison to the U.S., it's very low, especially in terms of gun crime. This is where especially I've been keeping up to date on a lot of the gun crime stuff, especially since Sandy Hook. And by comparison, you know, our gun crime is very, very low indeed. When I actually look at the crime rates and the death rates from gun-related incidents in the U.S., it astounds me. I mean, we went through 30 years of extreme violence and shootings and bombings in Northern Ireland here, and there was never once I can recall whereby people felt the need to really arm themselves. But you seem to have this culture, this this thing in the U.S. where everybody feels the need to arm themselves to protect themselves. But yet you do have, you know, the armed forces, you do have your police force. And personally, I just find that a little bit difficult to understand. So mm-hmm. I do, I mean, we've come through all of this, but never once during all of those, especially the bad years, no one ever thought of going out and buying some guns to protect themselves. They just relied on the security forces to do that.
So there's not a fear, so to speak, of Ireland, of maybe somebody breaking into your home and then having harm come to you. And then, because here, how we would think of that is that if somebody broke into our home, the response time between what bad could happen to you versus the time that the police response would be, that you're kind of, you're responsible for your fate in that gap, okay? And so if something was to happen to you in that gap, your only line of defense
yeah.
would be a gun, probably, okay?
Yeah.
And
yeah.
so, but in Ireland, are they not, they're not thinking like that, if somebody breaking into their home? Because we do have a lot of home break-ins here.
Well, we would. We obviously have burglaries and so on here as well, but probably not to the same extent. And if someone does break into their home, it's usually, they're not usually armed with a gun. They'd be armed with maybe a knife or something similar to that. Nevertheless, there's not that fear in terms of culture and in terms of we don't go around feeling fearful when I go to sleep at night. I don't feel that someone's going to break into my home. I don't have that, but it does seem, from an outsider looking into the U.S. situation, it seems a lot of people live this way. I mean, they live mm-hmm. with the idea that someone could possibly break in with a gun, or multiple people could break in with guns, and therefore you have to defend yourself. We don't have that same sort of fear here at all. It's not to say that it doesn't happen, but the incidents are not as many. Well, they're not that many at all, in fact.
Mm-hmm.
And usually if things like that happen, gun-related crime normally happens between criminal elements, maybe dissident terrorist
mm-hmm.
groups. It tends to work amongst those people mainly. But in terms of the general public, no, it just doesn't. It's not pervasive at all.
Really? Oh, that's interesting.
Yeah.
What are the
yeah.
gun rights in Ireland?
Pardon, sir?
Are you allowed to have a gun?
Oh, yes, you can apply for a gun. I mean, for example, a lot of the farming community would have guns, especially shotguns and so on. And, of course, you apply for the gun, you go through all of the background checks, the all of the usual checks that we would have in place here. Truthfully, I'm not familiar with what they are. But you go through all those checks, and then, of course, you can get your gun. In the main, it would tend to be shotguns and things like that. But again, it's the farming community would use those for pest control, or maybe they do feel isolated and maybe they do feel that they want to protect themselves. I have a friend who's in the south of Ireland, and I know where he has got a shotgun, which he rarely uses. But there again, it would be mainly for pest control on his farm. So...
Well, that is just incredible. It's such a different way of thinking. I mean, it's a great way of thinking. And in America, I think we all wish that it was that way, that guns were used for, you know, pest elimination or whatever, and you didn't have to even enter it into your brain as a necessity of living type of, you know, thing. Well, the Sandy Hook was just a complete, complete tragedy on, you know, so many levels. And, of course, we've had many tragedies like that here in the United States.
Yes.
And so even as a defender of the Second Amendment, I own a gun. We have a gun in our home. And, you know, like I said, a defender of the Second Amendment, I am aware that something, we're talking about balance in the last hour with our other guests with TV and film, but I'm aware that something is out of balance and something needs to be done. What that is, I don't know, and I feel a frustration as a human with what is going on. And I can see, I mean, I'm not an idiot, I can see that it doesn't happen around the world on a regular basis like it does in the United States, you know?
Yes.
And so...
Sorry?
Go ahead. No, go ahead.
No, I do feel... many people I know and many of my friends, and we talk about this, and then we look at the U.S., we see the rate of gun crime and how accessible guns are. I mean, for the very fact that you maybe go down into town or on the corner store, and there's a gun store, that is just incredible for us to comprehend, that you go in and you can just walk in off the street. And you go around and you go in, instead of shopping for your baked beans or your coffee or whatever, you instead you shop for a gun, and I think that's very, very difficult for us in Ireland to understand.
Mhm. Mhm. Yeah. Well, here it is tighter. You just can't. Well, you could walk in and walk out with a gun, but there is a, you know, there's a background check that goes on there. But yes, I mean, you could go to a place that sells diapers and beans and birthday wrapping paper, and you could also go to the gun counter. That would be
really
Walmart. You know, or, you know, stores like that have, you know, multi-purpose, you know, the super stores, there's all kinds of different things that go on. Now, in our home, we only have one gun. So we would probably be not seeing, well, some people might see that as extreme, only having one gun.
Yeah.
And then some people have lots and lots of guns, and some people would see that as extreme. So, and then I think some people fall in the middle, and some people have no guns. But here, it's just, I think most people probably have at least one gun in their home, you know, which, is just... I really never even thought about it until I really started talking to you, and then having your perspective come in, I'm like, really, the world, it's not as black and white
as I thought it was.
Yeah.
And one of the things I find as well, because it seems the U.S. has a different culture. It's got the hunting culture, for example. We don't have that here at all. And therefore... that's why, as an outsider, I cannot look on and just say, this is wrong, or you're crazy. Although I do think, certainly after the whole Sandy Hook thing, whereby the shooting, and where you had a guy who could go in with an assault-type weapon and firing multiple rounds with a magazine of 30 bullets in it, I do think that is crazy. I mean, I look on and I think, why do you have these particular weapons accessible to the public? Surely are they not a military style weapon? To me, that's where, somewhere along the line, you think, well, if I look at the American situation, there's no way you could remove all guns, but what you need to draw the line somewhere and say, well, what guns are you not permitted to have? And therefore, when I like to look on and I think of the AR-15s, the Bushmaster type, and you just think, why on earth would you need one of those things? I don't understand.
Right.
That's where I don't understand, and I look on and I think there's it's gone too far from an outsider's point of view.
Mm-hmm. And that, so with the Sandy Hook situation, and then having all of this perspective that you have about what's going on in America, it led you to write Masters of War. Why don't you tell us a little bit about that song, and then we'll take a break and we'll play it so people can hear it. I think that you did a really good job with that song. And like I said, even though I'm a supporter, I'm a defender of the, you know, I haven't really had to defend the Second Amendment, but I support it. And it wouldn't have occurred to me to write a song like that, but it really made me stop and think when you wrote Masters of War of what it touched a place that I was already struggling with internally about things being out of balance, and that there was so much violence, and there had to be some solution that both sides could live with. The fear in the United States is if you take away people's guns, that obviously just there's a lot of debate, but one of them is that then the criminal element does not go through background checks, and they would still, it would be almost impossible to take their guns away. Okay,
yeah.
And so then the honest law abiding citizens would have their guns taken away, but we still have that fear. You're not taking away the fear of somebody breaking into someone's home, and harm not coming to them. So that fear goes hand in hand with owning a gun. If you take away the law abiding person's gun, the criminal still has their gun. That fear is still there of someone coming into your home, and now you don't have that last line of defense, to speak. So you know, but there's got to be some type of balance, like you were saying, because obviously we can see that, you know, something is out of whack. And so you wrote this song, Masters of War, that we're going to play again here in just a moment.
Well, Masters of War, I grew up with, you know, listening to a lot of Bob Dylan. He was my hero, and he actually wrote a song called Masters of War in the early 60s, and it was very much a protest song about especially the armaments industry and the people who, you know, Dylan uses the phrase, you know, you hide behind walls, you hide behind desks, but I want you to know that I can see through your mask. And it was the whole idea of, you know, the people who make money on the back of armaments and guns and so on. And the younger ones, they go out and they get killed, but there's a lot of people make an awful lot of money on it. And that's why I chose to use the Masters of War Revisited, because I think I felt there's a lot of similarities to what was happening now. I mean, I do feel that while the NRA make all the noise about the Second Amendment, while they make all the noise about, you know, safety and everything, the bottom line for me, again, speaking as an outsider, it's all about money. I mean, they just want to make more money, and the more guns they sell, the more money they make. When they want to put guns in schools and so on, it's about selling more guns. Well, anyway, when I came back, you know, I thought of the song came about really as I watched things on the news concerning Sandy Hook, when I read things online, when I listened to all of the details. I was just absolutely, you know, I was shocked. I was very, very shocked about what had actually happened, how it had happened. I have a 7-year-old daughter, and I think that's what really brought it home to me, is when many of these younger children were riddled with bullets. They weren't just shot once. They were riddled between 3 and 11 times. And, you know, my daughter, the same. I could visualize the same thing happening to her, and what I would have felt like as a father. And of course, when I felt that way, I felt I've got to write something, I've got to say something, I can't be silent in this. And that's where the song actually came from.
Okay. Well, let's play it so that other people can listen, then we'll come back and talk about it. I find that your perspective is just so enlightening for me and so refreshing from the standpoint is that I appreciate knowing how other people outside of my culture perceive us.
Yeah.
And it's I think it's great, Andy, even though you and I have a little bit of a different viewpoint on that, I can certainly appreciate that. So we're going to play Master of War, and we're going to come back, and we're going to talk about it. So we'll be back in just a minute with Andy McCarroll.
Thank you. Thank you.
Damn you, Masters of War. Just look what you've done. You who make rifles, you who make the handguns, we see through your pretense, we see through your bluff. Don't you think that it's time?
And like Judas of old. You set out to deceive. More guns, the solution. You want us to believe. But it's all about money. Blood money is true. And I'm sure that even Judas wouldn't do what you do. I'm sure that even Judas wouldn't do what you do. Damn you, masters of war. Damn you, masters of war. Damn you, masters of war.
Andy McCarroll from Ireland, and his reaction to the Sandy Hook and other gun violence going on in the United States with his song that he sent over for us, Masters of War. It's interesting to see how the outside of the United States perceives the United States. It's not maybe from a judgmental standpoint, but it's trying to understand our culture and the maybe the frustration that even I as an American feel with gun violence. And they're also feeling that outside of the borders of the United States. And so there's a frustration globally and collectively as humans of how to deal with this and strike a balance, and that's what Andy's just on a search for, as most of us are here in the United States as well. Do you think that's right, Andy?
Yes, I do. I mean, the United States is a very different place from here, and therefore there's no way that I want to judge people at all. To me, the bottom line is that as long as the number of guns are in the U.S., you know, as they are, you know, I don't know how many millions of guns are there. As long as that, you know, persists, you know, everyone is going to need some sort of protection to ensure that they are safe. I think it's more to do with the level of weapon that is used. You know, somewhere along the line, there's got to be a level drawn, a line drawn as to, yes, these are acceptable, these are not. And obviously, I think that's where this whole debate about gun control and the kind of weapons that are available to buy, that this whole debate is going on. And obviously, too, about the size of the magazines that are used. I was just hearing there that Connecticut, if they've decided that they will limit the size of magazines to 10. Would that be, have you heard anything along those lines?
Yeah, I just thought they did sign that legislation yesterday in Connecticut. And what I'm hoping that by you and I talking is that we can show people, we could have a civilized conversation about guns without, I mean, you have a view that you're trying to understand, and I'm coming from my perspective, and I think you and I are having a very civilized conversation, and you're understanding a little bit about where I come from, and I'm certainly understanding where you're coming from on that, and it is, you know, as humans, we can have a discussion that doesn't invoke name-calling and screaming and yelling and shutting down of ideas and thoughts. And that's the only way we're going to get to some type of common-sense resolution is if we can talk to each other in this manner. And I can understand where you're coming from, and you can understand a little bit of where I'm coming from. And then somewhere in the middle lies common ground.
Yes, yes. I think the one big difference with the U.S. is the accessibility of guns. I mean, you can just walk down the street and there's a store and you can buy a gun. And that's where it's very, very different. And as long as people have such easy access to, especially the sort of the more assault type weapons and the weapons that can do more damage and rapid firing, et cetera, the more people are going to unfortunately die as a result of it all. If those things were limited, there would be less deaths. I think the more guns you have of this particular type, then it's reasonable to assume that there's going to be more deaths as a result of that.
Sure, yeah. It's it's a very deep-rooted issue. There's a level in the United States of distrust with government. I don't know if it's like that if other countries have that same level of distrust with their governments, but we certainly do in the United States. We have a distrust with criminal justice system to some degree, and of course we have a distrust with thinking that our ultimate protection lies in a third party.
Yeah.
And here it's just been ingrained into us that, you know, your ultimate survival or protection lies within your own hands. That you cannot count on somebody to get there in time. And like I said, it goes back to a basic fear of somebody coming in and doing you harm. And I will say that does happen. You know, it's happened to me in the past, and it's happened to other people I know. It happens every day. I mean, we are bombarded on TV with situation after situation after situation of crime here in the United States. So until I think that we see that crime is down and we don't need that protection, it's going to be hard for us to take that fear of protecting ourselves out of, you know, out of the equation. Now, how do you take, you know, an assault rifle into that situation? I can completely wrap my brain around that, and I'm going to be out of line with staunch Second Amendment supporters about that. I can see that if you are just a law-abiding good guy, good girl, you want an assault weapon, you know, you can have an assault weapon. But there's huge responsibility that comes with that. The lady at Sandy Hook, where the guns came from, she didn't take that responsibility. It does not appear very serious or as seriously as she should have, because her son was able to access those weapons. So if you do have those type of weapons, I think there's a huge, huge responsibility that comes with that, enormous. And maybe that responsibility is not worth the acquisition of that firearm.
Yeah.
But there's got to be some type of link in there. I don't want an assault weapon because I'd probably kill myself. But but if somebody else, you know, I don't know why you might need one, except for I grew up in a household where fear of invasion from other countries was prevalent in my home, and that
from other countries,
and that we might need to defend ourselves and I will tell you that still goes on right now in with many people I know, that if another country was to invade us, that we would have to be armed as citizens to defend ourselves. And I know lots of people, to be honest, now it just comes to my head, that they use that all the time, that if at the time during the Cold War, it was Russia. You know, if Russia was to invade or China was to invade or someone else, that we would need to, as a family, have or families within a neighborhood, that we would be militia.
Yes.
And I know people who think like that right now, to this day. Yes, absolutely.
Yes.
Mm-hmm. So that comes into it, too.
Yeah. Now, see, that's probably, again, part of your whole history. I mean, mm-hmm. I think the very, again, one big difference is the size of the U.S. I mean, it's a massive, you know, compared to Ireland, it's a massive place. And therefore, certainly, certainly when the Second Amendment was written, I mean, you had large areas of where there was no real law enforcement. And maybe there was definitely a need for people to protect themselves. But as time goes on, and where you do have law enforcement agencies in place, like we, for example, have here as well, I mean, somewhere along the line, you've got to hand over that. Well, this is the question I'm asking more than anything else. Surely you must hand that over to those agencies and trust them. But there again, I don't know the situation there at all. And,
right. And see, the argument would be more that that you would probably need self-protection more in a dense population than you would maybe even out. Well, although there's going to be argument for, you know, being out as well, but even in a dense population, you're going to have more of the criminal element coming at you, so the odds would go up that you would come in contact with the criminal element, and that the police, that there's a small amount of police and a large criminal element, and that the response time from the police to you, and that's the perception, would be, from the time here that you would call 911 to the time that the police would get to your house would be a few minutes, and what would be done in that time and in that circle of time would be between you and the criminal element. And the only thing, the argument would be, the only thing standing between you and that void of time would be how you could defend yourself.
Yes, yeah. I understand that, yes.
Okay, so you know it's going to go on and on and on, and you know it's a huge debate. I certainly can understand that it is out of balance, and I'm fascinated with how the rest of the world perceives us in that, and it's good to be able to have that viewpoint, because I can understand that it seems out of balance. I totally get that. And as a sensitive person and a sensitive soul, I wish that there was a better way. I don't know if the genie is so far out of the bottle in the United States that can ever be, but something, absolutely, you are 100% right. Something needs to be done. We cannot continue to have these tragedies at this epic proportion, and I think anyone can agree with that. And, and something absolutely has to be done. But let's talk about, Andy, the rest of you have other songs, and you're writing songs. You have a great website, andymccarroll.com. Great artwork on there. Who does the artwork on there? Do you do that?
Well, I actually designed it, and then I gave it to web designers, but the actual main cover was actually done as a competition with my children in school. I put it, these are 11-year-olds, and I said, this is what I would like to do, and I ran it as a competition in our, what we call Primary 7, their 11-year-olds. And that was the winning one, and I chose that, and I'm very, very pleased with it.
An 11-year-old did that?
11-year-old did that, yes. And that's the way I would tend to do it. I love children's art. I love children's work, and I think it has a freshness, and sometimes they will just do things the way they feel, the way they want to do something. my daughter was working there earlier on, and she had these three paper plates. But she, we have this program called Peppa Pig. Do you have that in the States? No.
Mm-hmm.
No, it's a children's program. And, of course, she had made Peppa Pig out of these three plates. And I think with children's art, they tend to, children just go with what they want to do, and they just do it. And I love that. I love the sort of the spontaneity of that, and the way they just, you know, they don't really think inside the box. They just do what they want to do, and they'll say, well, I want to use this, I want to use that, and I want to cut and stick this. I want to use paint here. I want to use felt or pens here. And they just go for it. And that's where it came from.
That's amazing. That is amazing. They did a great job. And you're right. At that age, they haven't been super influenced by outsiders saying don't do this or don't do that or that's wrong or you don't want to do that. It's complete freedom.
Yes. Yes.
What did they think about your singing and songwriting?
Well, I think they're beginning to know about it. I mean, I've only been doing since last July. That's when I started doing all of this. Before, and I don't know whether you know this, I used to work with a band called Moral Support. It was way, way back, and it was very much a sort of, had Christian roots. It was very much a sort of, I wouldn't say gospel stuff, but it was the whole new wave thing. That's where I started out. And then for a long time, I didn't do anything at all. I was a teacher. I decided I didn't want anything more to do with. I didn't want to tour. I didn't want to work in a band. I didn't want to. I just wanted to have a nice, easy life. And so I decided that, I'd go back to teaching. Love my job. I love teaching children. But just over this last number of years, I thought I'd love to write again, and this time not perform, but write. And I'm looking for other people, and that's where, if any of your listeners, if you've got people who really want to work in the music industry, then I would love to write for more people. And obviously in that, I'd have to, not only would they have to believe in me in terms of writing material, but I would have to believe in them in terms of their performance and ability to perform and real desire to make it in the music business.
Well, you'll probably get some people respond. What people don't understand is music is a tough business and it's a tough life. And I can understand you wanting to take a break and, go into teaching or something, because it is hard. It's a business, and that's what a lot of people don't understand about music. And that's what I found with a lot of musicians, is the hardest thing for them to navigate in music is the business and aspect of the music business.
Yes. Well, I think for me it was certainly that, yes. But from my early days, I grew up in sort of very much a Christian environment, and I went along to church and did all of that. And therefore, for a long time, when I started to write, it was all about Jesus. It was about very much church-based things. And when I stopped, I found that I couldn't really do anything else. I found it really difficult to write about ordinary life. It didn't seem to have the same meaning, the same, it just didn't have it for me at all. And I, to write about ordinary things or just about my perspective on the world, I just found it really difficult to do. And therefore, it's been the whole time out of it. I'm not really involved in church anymore. And I think it's being out of that has really helped me see a much broader picture. I feel in those particular days that it was very much life in a bubble, and I left lived life in a very narrow way. And it's only when I actually came out of that I started to think about other things and think about the broader aspects of the world that we live in. And And I find now that I can write about so many different things, and that's what I want to do, basically.
Absolutely. That's great. And that's one thing I want to mention, because I've had that same kind of epiphany. I grew up in a bubble, very narrow-minded. Well, and I think most people do, because your world is narrow and your sphere of influence is very narrow, and you just have the influence of your inner circle, your family, your parents.
Yes, that's right, yeah.
And then as you get out of that, you start seeing things differently. Well, because when you're a child, they can't really let you go out into the big world, you know, because there's, well, of course, in the United States, there's just so much to maybe be afraid of. We're kind of going back to that again. But but as you grow up, you start having different experiences. You start having kind of another life experience. And so it does. It broadens your view. You start seeing things from other perspectives. You can think about those things and marinate on them and come to different views. I think you're right on with that.
Yes, yeah. And obviously that's where I then – sorry?
No. I was going to say the same thing. It's obviously where you've come up with, you know, a lot of the things that you're writing about.
Yeah, I there's so many things that I want to write about, and not only in terms of relationships. It's really funny because when I was working with this band, Moral Support, it was very much, you know, as a Christian, I wanted to change the world. And then I came through a phase of, I am really tired of trying to change the world because I just can't do it. I'll be quite happy enough if I can change me. And therefore I came out of that whole thing, but it's really interesting. Therefore then I go around and I turn around and I write a song like Masters of War, which again is again wanting to change something. But there is that dimension to me, to what I want to write. But now it's so much broader. There are other things that I just want to just have fun songs. Things about life and my perspective on life and others' perspective on life as well.
Well, I think that's a good hook for a song that you just came up with. I can't change the world, but I can change me. You should write a song around that, because that's really the basis of the whole thing, you know.
Yeah.
You know, if you try to look at the whole perception of changing the world, it's just too huge. But if we just start with me and go from that point, it has little ripple effects that go out into the world, and small changes can be made, just like we were talking about in the last hour with Edward Fudge. You know, he just started with his little perspective, and then 30 years later, there's this huge film that comes out that you will have, obviously, ripple effects there. And so, but he just started with him. And then the same thing, you start with you, and I start with me, and here I'm talking to you from the United States, and you're in Ireland, and we have this great discussion, and it's just little things like that along the way, and that's forming this human chain and experience and linking them all together. I think it's fantastic. I think it's great. I've really enjoyed our conversation.
Yes.
Well, we're going to go out today with Circus. I'm going to play that one out today, Andy. I want people to go to your website, andymccarroll.com. I'll give you the final word.
Yes. Yes, and also probably the one, even more so than my website, I use my Facebook. It's just Andy McCarroll Music, and that's where I tend to do most of my postings, and, you know, that's where I make I probably use it more at the moment than my own website. But, yes, Laurie, it's been lovely talking to you. I hope I get a chance to talk again. The Masters of War, I enjoyed writing, and I'm really glad that I had a chance to speak about it and say to your listeners concerning it. Again, the bottom line is that I'm not wanting to be judgmental. I just want to ask questions. And I think if there's a way in which we can all have a better life for everyone, and especially our children, then it's really important to make for all of us to make really good choices and good decisions. even though it may be different to what we've done in the past. And that's, you know, that's what I wanted to do through that song. But I'm going to keep writing, and I'll keep on sending you stuff. And then if you want me back, I'll be very happy to come back and chat some more.
Well, you know, I'll have you back anytime, Andy. Anytime. And I just want everyone to know, now you see why I love Andy McCarroll. He's just a great guy. And he's asking questions. There's nothing wrong with asking questions. We should be, in fact, we encourage asking questions. That's, in the United States, that's, you know, we say that the First Amendment for freedom of speech. We need to be able to ask these questions, and we need to be able to have civilized discussions with friends who are, you know, have a little bit different life experience, and have to have these conversations. There's nothing wrong with that. Absolutely nothing wrong. We could only gain from that. And Andy, I really appreciate you coming on and sharing that with everybody, and especially me over the past year. And we will absolutely do this again.
Yes, and we'll keep in touch on Twitter, and anybody else who wants to join us, feel free.
Absolutely.
It's lovely talking to you, Laurie, after all of this time, and hopefully we'll get a chance to talk soon.
We will, definitely. Well, you have a good rest of your day. I know you are 8 hours ahead of us here, so my day's just beginning. Yours is coming to an end, and we're going to go out with Circus by Andy McCarroll. Find him on Twitter, find him on Facebook, and support his music, and absolutely let's join the conversation, but we're only going to have a civilized conversation. So if you're not civilized, you're not invited.
Thank you, Laurie. My pleasure.
All right,
too.
Andy.
Okay,
I'll talk
thank
to you soon. Bye-bye.
Okay, bye-bye.
All right, so that was Andy McCarroll. You understand why I enjoy him so much, and we're going to go out today with his song, Circus. Have a good day.
Once more the circus has come to town. You are the juggler and I the clown. Yes, you're the act that I won't forget. The one mistake that I regret. And I was goodbye and I was for good. No more tries, that was understood. Don't want you here messing up my brain. I did that once, but I won't do that again. Bump.
explode.